Welcome to Your Path to Nonprofit Leadership, the weekly podcast that features the very best in productivity and professional development in the nonprofit sector. I'm your host, Patton McDowell, and happy to bring you ideas and resources so you can build your professional development plan. Thanks, as always, for listening and for your great feedback. And speaking of that feedback, we've got a podcast survey up. Check out our website and please help us out. Tell us what topics you'd like me to cover, the types of guests you'd like me to interview, and anything else that we can do to make this podcast more effective for you on your nonprofit leadership journey. I had a fantastic conversation this episode with Daisha Relaford, who has taken her corporate and nonprofit experience and produced a fantastic book on managing change. It's called The Transformation Playbook, 7 Winning Strategies to Drive Sustainable Change. And she's currently in the corporate healthcare space, but you know, she started working for Teach for America in Chicago. So she blends her nonprofit, her community, and her corporate experience to produce a very accessible and practical guide. Daisha was very intentional about making this, as she puts it, a real world guide, something that you can really use and not be just theory, but help you manage change in the settings in which you operate. Now, the fact is, whether we like it or not, we are all having to manage change right now. And I think that's what makes this book even more timely. And Daisha and I talked about 3 of the 7 strategies in this episode that I hope will whet your appetite for, frankly, the book overall. And number 1, we talked about the actual writing, the composing of an effective vision for change that can be shared with all of your constituents. And number 2, we talked about how to communicate change to each of these constituencies so that it is effective and they in turn can articulate what you are trying to accomplish. And finally, we talked about, and perhaps the most interesting discussion was, how do you deal with detractors? As much as we hope that everyone will join the pep rally for this new change or this new strategic vision, but the reality is everyone is not going to be on board. How do you deal with those detractors and keep your change plan in motion? Lots of good content to unpack here, and I hope you'll not forget to check out the show notes. This is episode number 70. Just go to the podcast or the news page at pattonmcdowell.com, and you'll find all of the resources, the links, books, of course, Daisha's own great book. You'll find out more about how to get your hands on it, as well as some other books and recommendations that she made. Speaking of resources, if you're looking for things that can help you on your professional development journey, resources like this book and like this podcast, another one we offer is a Mastermind Leadership Coaching Program. We've just opened the applications for the spring cohort. So if that is something of interest, make sure you check that out on our website and learn more. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Daisha Relaford. Daisha, thank you for joining me on the path.
Absolutely. So happy to be here today. Thanks for the invite.
Well, I'm excited to talk about your career journey and obviously the inspiration that led to this fantastic book we're going to talk about. It's called The Transformation Playbook, 7 Winning Strategies to Drive Sustainable Change. And it's so timely. You know, I think nonprofit leaders everywhere are dealing with change, whether they like it or not. And you have provided, I think, some practical advice that they can apply, and each one of our listeners can apply to a change management exercise, maybe that's underway or one that's on the horizon. And so we're going to definitely unpack the book for sure. But Daisha, let's start with you. Kind of talk a little bit about your career journey and then ultimately what led to this book.
Sure. For the listeners out there, I think I've had a fascinating career journey. You know, my passions throughout my entire life have been centered around education and healthcare. And I actually started off as an elementary school teacher. You know, I have a lot of passion, and definitely nonprofits are at the heart of how I think about the world and work that I want to contribute to, because I spent a lot of time volunteering for nonprofits in college and really had an opportunity to start working with students and understood the importance of preparing tomorrow's leaders. So I joined Teach for America. I did 3 years teaching elementary school in Chicago, and then realized, you know, I'm committed to education long-term, but really wanted to get back to my other passion in healthcare. and then have spent the rest of my 20-year career really working in healthcare, in sales roles, in marketing roles, in consulting roles. And now I work for a pharmaceutical distribution company in a role focused on transformation. So it's been an exciting career. That's definitely connected a lot of my passions while ensuring I'm really empowering people to live their best lives, which is not only inspiration for my career, but inspiration for why I wrote this book.
Well, that's fantastic. And I love how you kind of combine that experience from nonprofit and for-profit, which I think strengthens everything that you're sharing with the readers of your book and, of course, with our listeners today. Before we get into the book itself and some of the practical wisdom that you have, I'm asking all my guests, Aisha, clearly you know how to manage your time well with all that you're doing professionally and personally, and you are writing a book. How do you stay organized? Have you found anything in particular during this virtual world in which we live?
Sure. I mean, there are a couple things I do. Of course, none of us are perfect. I'm still learning every day.
Right.
But my first tip is I'm old school, so I still make a weekly to-do list. It's part of my Sunday night, Monday morning ritual.
Nice.
And what's important about my to-do list is it includes both what I have to do for work and what I feel like I must do in my personal life. I integrate those so that I make sure that I'm successful both personally and professionally. So that is my North Star, so to speak, for the week. And then the other thing that I do, and I think it's so important in a virtual world, is I really try to cut off work by 6:30, so that I can get to those personal things. I mean, you mentioned me, you know, having the opportunity to write a book, and that was important for me to spend my evenings focused on this work. And you have to kind of turn off one area to focus on another area. Otherwise, if you continue to blend them, I find that you're less effective in both.
That's fantastic advice, and I concur. The point, David Allen is an author favorite of mine, talks about getting things done process and the fact that you do have to have a list that balances your personal and professional life. In other words, you don't want to have separate to-do lists. It all certainly comes together. I'm curious, as an aspiring author, I'm working on a book myself, Aisha. So you took a big project like that and made it kind of a separate evening ritual. I'm just curious for listeners who maybe are embarking on a project like a book, how did you build that into your routine?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And if you're like me, you try to do everything well, which means everything takes a lot of time. And so for me, it was important to create an environment of focus. So I actually went to a book camp in early 2019.
Interesting.
And it was great because I was with other people who wanted to write a book. And we spent 3 days focused on nothing but the book. So that really gave me a running start to my outline and to most of the draft of my book. After that, I had to then, you know, self-focus, so to speak, my evenings, my weekends on getting this work done. And actually what I found was, you know, this process of writing a book, it wasn't about me not having enough time. It actually was about me getting in the mindset that my work was worth somebody else hearing. And I found I was procrastinating because of what was going on in my head versus me not having enough time to do it. And that's been part of my journey in terms of learning about myself and what keeps me from accomplishing my goals. So that's something I would ask, you know, listeners to think about is it really time that's the obstacle? Or is there something going on in your mind where you are inadvertently telling yourself that it can wait, or you're a little nervous about putting your work out there? But that was a little bit of my ritual. So having coaches, having people that also held me accountable and would always ask me, how's your book coming? Are you done with the editing? How's right. this portion? So having that accountability and those other components really helped me kind of push through, even with COVID and everything we're going through right now, to finally getting it published. And I'm happy I did.
Oh, absolutely. And I can see why. And I love that in terms of accountability, and the things that may hold us back are indeed in our head. And it sounds like book camp was in essence a retreat, right? It became a platform on which you built this whole book project, and successfully so.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I think whenever you're doing something for the first time, it's always great to surround your people who have done around yourself, excuse me, with people who have done it before, And who could at least show you methods. You may tweak it a little bit, but I found that helpful as a guide for as a first-time author.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, the book Camp maybe is a good segue to the topic, the headline of our episode together. Your book talks about transformational change and a playbook to do so. Talk about the why. I mean, what inspired you to write this book? I'm guessing there were experiences in your professional life, maybe where you saw transformation occur or not occur, or you tell me what inspired the book.
Sure, Pat. No, I appreciate that. I mean, several things really inspired this book. You know, over the last decade of my career, which as we mentioned earlier, I started in corporate America, I've worked around transformations. I've been a project manager. I've led large scale transformations for leading companies. I've coached people through transformations. And you see common errors that continue to happen. And, you know, there's a statistic that McKinsey put out a couple of years ago that 70% of transformations fail. And the reality is transformation is hard work because you're dealing with mindsets and behaviors and cultures. And those are hard things, not only to change, but to sustain that change over time. And so for me, I've learned a lot, sometimes from hitting my head and doing something that wasn't successful, other times by being successful, and finally by watching other leaders. I tend to watch how other people lead and see what makes them successful in their own styles. And so a combination of those three really, you know, helped me to package what had been in my brain in terms of what I think could really help people be successful. And what was important for me is it had to be practical. Yeah. For the average person out there who's trying to lead this, frameworks and theories are great, but what can I go do tomorrow? And that's really what I wanted to accomplish with this book.
Oh, I love that. And I'm looking at the table of contents right now. And in fact, it illustrates the book itself in terms of the practical application. Each of your chapters breaks down and frankly gives practical advice. And that's, to me, for any organization, or any sector, you know, for-profit or nonprofit, that is helpful. And I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You definitely see practical application for a nonprofit leader as opposed to kind of the corporate sector, which you've also had experience?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as I wrote this book, I wanted to write it for all professions and all industries. And definitely, you know, as you think about the nonprofit world, similar to the rest of the world, you're having to adapt to a lot of change in the landscape, in the environment, whether this year it's COVID. And for some of you, your landmark, your key events that you typically hold to bring in donors, you had to do differently. So what is the process by which you think about embracing that change and transforming your organization and how you think about that? I mean, there are other things going on as well around political and social unrest and where you may be rethinking funding priorities. And then finally, even long-term sustainability for a lot of nonprofits. You may be reevaluating your mission and trying to figure out how to align to changing customer needs. And so it's really important as you think about how you undertake whatever your strategic initiatives are, that you have a plan and process, not only to execute it effectively, but I think what my book is focused on is how do you sustain that beyond you, beyond one person, to really embed it in the organization. And I think that's really critical for long-term change.
No, it's fantastic. In fact, a teaser maybe to a chapter we're not going to talk about, but we'll encourage our listeners to get the book. But you indeed talk about maintaining momentum and that this is not kind of a time-limited process. If it's going to be successful, it has to sustain. And that's embedded, I think, in all of your advice. Let's start with what is indeed chapter one. You title it "Writing the Vision," but if I'm a nonprofit leader, I'm perhaps overwhelmed or not sure exactly how to embrace a transformational process. What is kind of the important part of writing the vision, and why do you start there?
Sure. I mean, to know where you're going, you have to know where you are today, and it's going to be clear, you as the leader, whether you're the leader of your organization or the leader of this initiative, all of you are leaders, you have to know where you're taking people and they have to be on board with where they're going. And so writing the vision is really coming up with that common focus. simple, inspiring, that will lead people to the outcome that you're ultimately looking to achieve. And it sounds easy. You know, we all have vision and mission statements, but there is some strategy to crafting a vision that really will align your stakeholders and feel like everyone is working together. And that's really what I wanted to tackle in this chapter.
Well, I figured I was going to ask you that. I mean, does it indeed start with simply having good conversations? I think a lot of leaders sometimes feel like their vision is clear. They articulated it beautifully with all this poetry in their mission and vision statements. But I think your sense is if you don't have these conversations, you're not going to find common ground.
Absolutely. You have to have the conversations, and sometimes you have to think about things independently. So if you feel like you're too close or you're too biased to kind of see other viewpoints, I would actually recommend you have somebody who feels a little bit more independent do these interviews for you. What do people want in the organization as it relates to wherever your strategic initiative is trying to take them? What have been the challenges? Even when you write the vision statement, for example, the words that you use matter.
Right.
Are the words that you're using, are they going to resonate with all stakeholders? Or are they just going to resonate for your organization? Right. And when you think about your stakeholders, some may be inside your organization, but there are probably several constituents that are outside your organization. So it's really important that you listen to the stakeholders, hear what they need, and then build a vision that really focuses on those common needs. And keeping it simple is critical as well.
You make an interesting point, or several interesting points, but one about kind of an independent voice in this process. Is the concern that perhaps people will tell you what you want to hear and you won't really get the truth behind where this organization might go? Or is that kind of why you're reinforcing that having that independent person to maybe do some of these interviews will gather, you know, more accurate information?
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes if we're all being honest, it's hard to see our own blind spots.
Right.
Especially if you're looking to evolve something that already exists. And depending on the stakeholders you want to interview, you know, to your point, they don't necessarily want you to feel bad about what we haven't accomplished together or what their needs really are. So sometimes bringing in someone who's independent, or it could just be someone else in your organization who isn't as close to some of these stakeholders, is critical. But
right.
I would also urge people to interview people at different levels of the organization. You know, I think that is definitely a common mistake I've seen, is leaders just talk to other leaders, but they're not on the ground every day. They
yes.
don't know what's happening at the base. And so you're building solutions that actually won't have impact. And so it's really critical, even as you think about your stakeholders, that you're truly getting a cross section of all of the people being impacted. And that's one of the, I'll call it practical steps that I do break down in chapter one, so people know how to approach that. How do you build good stakeholder lists before you go out and do that listening?
That's fantastic. And indeed, I've seen it as well, where we, if we just do our strategic planning with the leadership team, so to speak, we're missing such valuable feedback, aren't we, from those folks on the front line, the volunteers, you know, the parents of the people we serve, or whatever audience that might be, patients. Good for you to remind us of that cross-section. You also make a point, Aisha, about making it inspiring. Yeah. Talk about that again. How do we make this kind of written vision inspiring?
Yeah, no, you want, with any vision statement, and I'm sure this isn't a surprise to anyone, you want people to feel energized by what you're asking them to do. So there are a couple very practical ways I think you make it inspiring. First of all, the vision, and this may be counterintuitive to how you think about it, it needs to be short. It needs to be something that people can actually recite.
Right.
So if you have a 5-sentence vision, nobody is going to be able to remember it. They're not going to be able to tell anyone else about it. There's going to be 5 different versions of how people talk about that vision.
Right.
So that's really hard, right? Making things short and concise, where every word matters, where the key words that are the focus are embedded in there and well understood. Like that's what's hard, but also gives you something inspiring to rally around. I even, you know, encourage people to use some imagery, right? Create a nice one-page charter page with some bright colors and, you know, an inspiring image of the vision and what your project name kind of entails, right? So how you name it is also important. I find for these long-term strategic initiatives, it's important to give it an empowering name along with that simple, impactful vision statement that anyone, a five-year-old, a 95-year-old could repeat.
I love that. And you're right. If it's not memorable and it gets buried in our minds, which already have too much data to process, that is such a good idea to both have the words and the image that will make it memorable. And again, as you know, in the nonprofit sector, yeah, we're relying on often volunteers who are not paid to remember all this stuff. But we need to give them enough information so they can be ambassadors for the cause for which we are dedicated. And so that's fantastic. Let me ask a question, Aisha, before I forget. In terms of the process, I assume it varies, or do you advocate for a certain timeline around processes like these, or is it completely dependent on the organization?
It's dependent on the organization. You know, I would recommend, of course, before you do anything, you build the vision.
Right.
And you take the time needed to talk to all of these different stakeholder groups. As you mentioned, even with volunteers, right? You want them to buy in. You got to go talk to people if you want people to buy in. You just can't assume that they'll be along for the ride. They want to contribute. So you want to make sure that you have the opportunities for others to contribute. But I think it's so important that you are organized around a timeline, because otherwise this work could go on and take too long at the same time, right? So I don't want to give a particular time frame, but stay organized, have a schedule around how you're interviewing, divide and conquer, get other people involved with interviewing stakeholders, which is actually a good change management methodology. Sometimes the people who need to change need to be the ones hearing how some stakeholders feel the current state is and where they want to go. So I actually strategically have certain people interview for that reason, to help drive change management amongst others.
That's a great point. And because it leads to, I guess, a thought, the cynical listener, and we both have been part of these processes, Daisha, where, you know, there's a lot of excitement early and there's fancy posters and mission and vision statements, but it just doesn't go anywhere. But you embed throughout the book and even into this first process, you know, how do we create an action orientation to follow? So maybe you could talk about that. How do we get from that memorable image and language into actually doing stuff?
Absolutely. So there are a couple of ways. So we've kind of talked about the high level vision that you want to create. Connected to that, and I always tend to think in threes, you want to have some specific actionable goals. You know, many of you probably know the SMART methodology, right? Specific,
right.
Measurable, actionable, right? Results oriented. But you really want to know what are, if you had to divide up the initiative in chapters or specific accomplishments that you want to achieve, what would those be? And how could you write that in an action oriented way so that you can build a project plan around how to get there? And once again, it helps everyone else know where we're going and what that is going to look like. So that is really important to keep things action-oriented, because if they're just high-level fluff, for lack of a better word, nobody knows where we're going or how we're gonna get there. So I really believe in being clear and writing those actionable goals that really support that broader vision.
Yeah, we've all been through enough fluff in our life, professionally in particular. And I have run into many nonprofit leaders, board members, staff that kind of roll their eyes, you know, at processes that don't seem to go anywhere, but love the fact that you've kind of articulated a process that will help you avoid that. And so we'll get more into
that. And on that point, if I
yeah.
just add one more thing,
sure.
I mean, metrics. You have to have metrics. How are you going to determine the success? And I've been a part of nonprofits. I understand, you know, some metrics, you know, are more qualitative in nature, I'll call it. And of course, there are dollars and other metrics that I know nonprofits track, but it's really important that you are measuring your progress against success.
Yes.
In using KPIs, you know, key performance indicators that are meaningful to the ultimate work that you're doing and to your stakeholders.
Yeah, that's so well put. And we both appreciate the well-intentioned vision that is aspirational and wants to change the world. But you're right. If it's not tied to any metrics, ultimately, it's hard to measure progress and or inspire, you know, further dedication and investment, right, in our causes if we're not showing progress.
Absolutely.
I'm going to give the listener a quick journey through the table of contents. We're not going to talk about each chapter, but after writing the vision, you talk about building the case for change. You talk about achieving a quick win. And then let's move into a topic we'll talk about. The fourth chapter talks about communicating progress. So back to your one of your headlines throughout, Daisha, right, is we've got to communicate this effectively. So talk about, I guess, the genesis of that chapter and why it's so important to communicate progress.
Sure. In general, we all can communicate better. You know, sometimes I think, you know, we look at communication as what we say, but it's really what people hear. And so our job as leaders driving transformation to make sure they hear what we need them to hear and they are inspired to act on that. Because remember, we are asking people to do something new. So they have to both embrace what you're saying and feel like they can then go act on it and want to go act on it. And so this chapter really is focused on how do you figure out and come up with the right strategic plans for all of your stakeholders around communication. And it may sound easy. Hey, I'm just going to send some emails. Like you said, I'll have some flyers. But what I want, you know, listeners to think about is we got to be more specific than that. We've got to be more targeted than that. And that's what this book hopefully this particular chapter is walking everyone through.
I love that. But Daisha, if I have a fancy three-ring binder that has my strategic plan, isn't that enough? Or are you suggesting, in fact, that there are different types of communication channels? I wonder what are some other examples or how might I go about translating this plan into these different channels?
Yeah, so absolutely. You've got to use a multitude of channels. And that's what I've found has been most successful is everyone learns differently. So even if you're thinking about one stakeholder group, let's just take volunteers, for example. They all don't receive communication the right way. So it's nice that you send emails, but you may need to look at other types of audio or digital communication formats, maybe an app. I know we're on a podcast today. There are a lot of different ways that you have to think about based on the change, how you're going to reach people. And you want to go where they naturally go for information, because as many of you may have heard this stat as well, it typically takes someone 6 times to hear something before they really understand it. So if you think you can say something once or even twice and it's enough, it's not going to be enough. And so really understanding where to put the information in a way that isn't like, oh, here they go again. Here's another email asking me to do X, Y, and Z. Then it'll become a little stickier and really help people embrace that change. So it's not only the channels you use, but it's also the different people, quite honestly, who can be involved in delivering that communication.
That's such a good point. And I'm often struck by the fact, and I've been guilty myself, I think we choose maybe the communication channel we're most comfortable and we predetermine that, you know, this process is going to produce a slick printed, you know, guidebook or something, when we should have, and I guess your suggestion is we should have thought about our target audiences first and which channels are they in and most comfortable in, and that should determine how we, you know, roll this out.
Absolutely. And going back to what we talked about with writing the vision, remember, you're already going to have these more in-depth conversations with your stakeholders. You need to ask, this is a question you need to ask them.
Absolutely.
You know, what are the best ways for us to communicate with you? How do you want us to communicate with you? You know, because some groups will be more comfortable with bite-sized communication. Others will say, hey, I do want something in written form so I can refer back to it. And they're visual learners. So that's information you've got to gather until you see some commonalities where you can satisfy the majority of your stakeholder base.
Well, and I think it's perfect. And you also address, I think, a common mistake is that there's this kind of a flurry of communication right at the, you know, maybe the completion of the plan. But you are suggesting that, you know, we need to really have a cadence and really maybe a longer term communication plan. It's not just simply the debut of the process itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the cadence is going to change based on the stakeholder group. You know, for example, I mentioned, and there's parts in the book that really talk about who all the different stakeholders are that you're working with. So that's part of chapter one. And I think it's also in chapter two a little bit. But it's really important that those that you're working most closely with, I like to call them your change agents, you're going to be communicating with them more frequently.
Right.
So the channels you use, the cadence may be weekly. It may be, you know, depending on some of the folks, daily, every other day. It's going to be a different cadence by which you're sharing information. And that's all communication is, right? Sharing information. And it's important. They're also sharing information with you. So when we talk about communication, it's not just you talking to them, by the way.
Right.
It's them talking back to you about what they're hearing and seeing versus, you know, an executive sponsor, right? The head of your board who maybe is on a different cadence of once a month in the beginning when things are more intense, to your point, but that cadence can change and should change over time as the initiative and the strategic work moves forward. So understand that the cadence at the beginning isn't necessarily the cadence at the middle. And definitely not when you're trying to maintain momentum. So it's important to know how that cadence needs to change. And it should move as the work moves, right? So as the work becomes more intense, there should naturally be more communication. When you get to a more steady state, then you can relax that cadence a little bit more.
That's a great point. And again, I guess it seems to me from a practical standpoint, you may set a, maybe even the next 12 months is a framework, but as you put it, we've got to incorporate continuous feedback and maybe talk about that, because I guess that would then allow you to adjust as you're suggesting.
Absolutely. And this is a huge mistake that I see made a lot of times.
Really?
We just do not, the communication, we think we're doing a great job, but we're not asking for feedback. And it is sometimes hard as a leader because, you know, depending on what the strategic initiative's focus is, this is your baby, right? This is something you care a lot about. You're bought in and you want to drive and lead it. But if it's not working, you need to know. And the only way you know is by creating an environment where people are able to give you that feedback. And there are several ways that you should think about getting feedback. Definitely informally.
Right.
You want people to feel comfortable picking up the phone, shooting you an email. And so even as you communicate, always make sure that you include that you're open for feedback, that you want to hear back from them, right? So if you have a town hall as a communication strategy, have time during that town hall where you take questions. And it's important that, you know, you take questions from individuals who are comfortable to stand up and be connected to their question. But it's also important that you give people a way to give anonymous feedback, because there are people who don't want to hurt your feelings.
That's right.
There are people who are a little uncomfortable to say something that's uncomfortable. And so you also want to provide avenues and ways that they can give feedback. So going back to the town hall example, ahead of the town hall, or maybe there's a box, right? Once we're, you know, in the post-COVID state, and people can just drop questions in the box,
right,
that aren't attached to their name that then can be answered at the end. So people really appreciate having different avenues to give informal feedback and then more formal feedback. You absolutely should circle back to different key stakeholders, including those who you know are not on board with your initiative and your transformation, and sit down and ask them questions. What do you like? What do you not like? How's the communication going? Is your team receiving this? What could I do better?
Yeah,
those are simple questions, but you'll get a wealth of knowledge if you really allow people to provide that feedback to you.
No, such a good point. But again, to reinforce what you're saying, you know, we got to build that in, don't we? It's not simply kind of splash out this information and expect everybody just to run with it and agree with it. You're going to build in a cadence of both communication and feedback that frankly assures progress. And, you know, something else that struck me, particularly in the nonprofit sector, is what you said about how we enable others to help deliver the message. And I'm thinking about nonprofit leaders who want volunteers, they want staff and board to also be able to articulate the vision. That have you seen in particular ways, how do we help enable others to deliver this communication?
Sure. No, that is a great point, and that's really important. So through all of these listening sessions and feedback sessions, you should be able to synthesize either common questions that people are giving and common answers that you want to make sure that are shared with those particular stakeholders. So whether you can create a guide, you know, sometimes I create PowerPoints.
Nice.
Simple PowerPoints. And the goal there is, remember, we're moving forward, right? You have these key milestones that you're hitting along, you know, your transformation. So as you communicate updates, progress, impact, right, metrics, not just the fluffy stuff, it's important to send out all these agents, so to speak, to deliver those messages to their constituents or to the groups that they are in touch with in terms that make sense for that group, right? So there might be, your content might be slightly different for the volunteers than for the parents than for the board, but the core content is the same. And so I like to create that PowerPoint, but also have speaker notes. It's important that everyone that you empower feels comfortable delivering the message. So the message, once again, needs to be simple. I'm a big believer in keeping communication simple and concise. And at the same time, you want to provide speaker notes in case they get common questions that they feel confident answering. And then they can just be themselves on top of that, right? But you've given them a nice guide that really empowers them with the right information, while you can also ensure that you have a consistent message going out. And that's another thing that I see with transformation. Multiple people working it, but oh, such and such said this, but you're saying this, right? There is an alignment of that message. And that's really why having that vision is so important, because all of your messages should circle back to how the progress is supporting the vision that we launched in the beginning. And so it becomes very circular and reinforcing of itself. And all of your communications should reinforce those key messages.
Yeah, I really like your reinforcement of that consistency. And you're right. Again, a failure would be to kind of think we can deliver the message once and expect everybody to continue to run with it. Because you're right, people will translate it differently and they'll get feedback independent of us and then they translate it differently again. I also love the fact you're suggesting these kind of frequently asked questions that would provide an opportunity to kind of reassemble leadership, wouldn't it? And say, hey, here's some questions we've been getting. Here's the best way to respond. And that would strengthen their confidence and maintain consistency of message.
Absolutely. I mean, that is so critical. And you have to update it and refresh it. And that's why you have to know what's going on in the organization,
right?
How they're reacting to whatever aspect in the transformation that you're in, so that you're providing relevant content. I mean, so much of communication is, of course, how you say it, but what you're providing as well. And if the content isn't relevant, you're also not going to have good communication. And so really those couple of things work hand in hand together. And the other thing I do sometimes, I just share this as a tip, to prepare those who I call your extended communication team, your ECT.
Right.
You know, I like to have office hours for them. A time where they can just come and ask me questions about, okay, I'm getting these questions. Because the people who are communicating on your behalf or on behalf of the vision, they're getting beat up out there sometimes, right? They're getting tough questions. It's not always fun to be them. And so it's important that you as the leader are there to support them, to reinforce, to give them confidence, right? They may have questions. And so you want to make sure you're available to answer questions that they have or things that they're seeing so that you are being supportive of their efforts so that they'll want to continue to go out and continue to champion that message.
That's fascinating. So in other words, I know you, I'm sure, communicate, hey, my door is always open, but you're saying by declaring office hours, does that just have kind of a more specific reminder that, hey, I really do want you to give me some feedback?
Absolutely. I want some feedback and I want to hear what's on your mind. And I like to schedule those because, you know, people like to drop in. And I think that's just really important that you have that, because even through all of this, you're building relationships with people. You're building relationships with people who are on board with your transformation. You're building relationships with people, quite honestly, who are detractors. And it's important to really make yourself available, not only by saying it, hey, call me anytime, but really designating time where your goal is just to listen and to support others. Because the reality is no one person can drive change, and you have to have a team, and you have to empower that team to be as effective and more effective than you are. And they're really going to be the ones that help you drive and make that change sustainable.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that. And of course, you and I both remember from our college days where, you know, faculty had office hours, and that did at least give you a sense of, I know I could stop by then and maybe get some time. But a lot of nonprofit leaders, I think, are incredibly busy. And in some cases, they self-isolate, or everyone around them assumes they're so busy that, well, I'm not going to stop by. But wouldn't it be interesting if nonprofit leaders said, hey, you know, every Thursday afternoon from 2 to 4, I'm not going to schedule anything else. It's a drop by period. I wonder if that wouldn't create just such a really dynamic communication channel.
Absolutely. No, I think it's important, and it sends a signal to people. It matters, right? So we're talking about transformation. And if transformation, your organization is going through a major time of change,
right,
you've got to be available. This has to be important to you. And so prioritizing is going to be critical. And we might not have time to talk about it today, but one of the things I talk about is if you're taking on something as a leader, you need to talk to your leadership about other things that you may not be able to do.
Right.
Because you need to focus your time and attention on this. And so I know for many nonprofits, but I can't drop anything. Well, empower somebody else in your organization to pick up those must-dos, right? Those essential activities that need to get done. And that's part of transformation too, is making sure we allow the space and the time to do the work. And that's why a lot of transformations fail, because we try to do the easy button version, and there is no easy button.
Exactly.
We've got to do the work. We've got to put in the time, and you will be successful if you do that.
So well put. And so now we're 4 chapters in. We're excited. We've have the pep rally feeling of assured success. However, we all run into the detractors. And so I'm so glad that chapter 5 allows you to get into that, because we've all been there. You know, we feel good and we get deflated by these detractors. So how do we identify and deal with the sometimes negative element when we're trying to create transformational change?
Absolutely. I want to talk about this because this is real, right? And that's what I want to make sure my book is. It's real. This is the real work that happened. And the first thing I want to just, you know, remind people is having detractors is not a bad thing. I mean, it may feel like it's going to slow you down, but I find that, you know, having detractors ensures that I have the best vision possible, that I sharpen my communication, right? They make you better. They make the strategic work better. So I really want to change people's mindset about how they view detractors, because I think that's critical. In terms of how you identify them, I mean, it's the people asking a bunch of questions.
Yep.
Well, we've never done that before. We tried that 3 years ago and it didn't work.
Yep, heard that.
I don't think I have time for that. Can we pay for that? You know who they are. They're coming up with 100 reasons why this can't work. And they're either saying it, or their body language is showing it. And so those really are detractors. And some of them honestly may surprise you who they are. Because
right,
you're thinking, I think they want to do this. Why are they putting up an obstacle? Why do they keep moving these meetings back? Why do they keep delaying, you know, giving some feedback on this new vision? And spending time with them really helps you understand what is going on in their brain. And I'm a salesperson, right? So I like to win people over.
Right.
And so the way I'd like all of you to think about detractors, these are just people you need to win over.
Good.
And that's okay. And that's part of the process.
I mean, so intentionally invite them into planning meetings. I guess it's the old adage of, you know, keep your friends close, but your enemies even closer. Because I guess it would be easier sometimes to avoid the negativity. But you're suggesting, no, we actually need to be proactive and make sure we connect with them.
Oh, absolutely. We need to bring them to the table, because the reality is some of your detractors are some of the most influential people within your organization,
right,
and the environment of your organization. We need them, and you need them to sharpen your message and sharpen your communication. Because remember, you're not just communicating to people who are bought in, you're communicating to people who aren't yet bought in, who are a little skeptical, who are a little nervous. And your detractors give you insight to what they're thinking, to what they're feeling. And it's important, you know, there, you could be like, well, I have a lot of detractors out there. Which ones do I listen to? And one of the things I talk about in this chapter is all detractors are not equal.
Okay.
You need to focus on those detractors who have influence, who could actually derail the impact of this strategic change, of this transformation, of this change program, if they are not at the very least neutral or positive towards this change. I think there's a thought sometimes that everyone needs to be rah-rah for the transformation for it to be successful. And I'd like you to think that's not necessarily true. You don't want them to be negative, but sometimes getting them to a neutral position is good enough. And
right.
So this chapter really talks about how we should think about that as well.
I love that. And you're right. If, I guess if they have budgetary control or they're a veteran of the organization that has a lot of influence, but is what you're suggesting that we literally almost create a list of detractors and then say, all right, well, who among this list is most influential? And that becomes my priority for more collaboration.
Absolutely. Make a list of all the detractors. And in this chapter, I say, if you can't come up with someone, I'm actually really nervous. That makes me more nervous if you can't come up with a detractor. Because my question to you would be, well, are you really changing anything if everyone's
exactly.
on board? So you might have a different problem there. But make that list, but then go through each individual on that list and say, what happens if they're not on board? Is it a major issue for me? Like you said, do they control budget? Do they control resources? Do they just have influence?
Right.
Are they someone that others look to for direction? And so once you kind of segment who's really most important, I like to do an activity where you map where they are, you know, and I mean, it could be as simple as a 0 to 10 scale, with 10 being super positive towards the transformation and 0 being like, they won't even pick up the phone if you call them about this topic, right?
Right.
And map where they are today. And then think about where do you need to get them to, right? So it's kind of a little bit of current state versus future state. And that really becomes the focus of the very customized plan that you create for each detractor, is understanding how much to the right, how much more positive do they need to be in order to make your initiative successful. Once again, some just getting to neutral is good enough. And that's what your focus, the activities that you involve them in, the time that you spend with them, the role that you give them in the transformation, even as part of that, in order to get them to those positions. And you continue to monitor that over time.
Well put. And I guess, like you mentioned earlier in communicating progress, we just need to be consistent, right? In not just seeking one-time reaction from our detractors, but make sure we stay in touch with them, right?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that literally was on the tip of my tongue. That is another pitfall that I see so many times. Great, we'll talk to them in the beginning. We'll find out what they don't like. Okay, thanks, bye. It is so hard, and I understand, right? You're getting some momentum going with the transformation. The last thing you wanna do is talk to someone who's a naysayer, right? And it's gonna tell you what's still wrong, why it's still not working,
right,
why this isn't the right thing or the right time to do something. But it's so important that you keep them engaged. When they see your persistence and they see how you are committed to either getting them to buy in or to make the proper concessions that really allow them to buy in, you'll win people over. And if nothing less, you'll win their respect, that you are concerned about what they have to say and that you want to continue to have discussions until they either see the vision or can find a way to support the vision at the level that you need them to do it at.
Well put, Daisha, as you have throughout our conversation and throughout the book, both inspired our listeners, I know, and readers of the book, but also given us practical advice. And you promised that, and you're delivering that, and that's what makes this so engaging. To tease our listeners a bit more, we're not going to get into it today, but you continue with the book, chapter 6. You talk about building and inspiring a team of champions. And then you finish with, which I think is critical to your point, maintaining momentum past the tipping point. But without getting into that now, they're going to have to read it to learn more. But are there any other thoughts, Stacia, as you consider particularly nonprofit leaders that are either experiencing or considering transformational change? What other advice might you offer?
Yeah, I mean, my advice is stay with it. Really think through the time that's going to be required, the resources, and resources being a project plan, right? Resources aren't always dollars. And what I try to do throughout this book is give you ways to even reward people that don't cost money, you know, because I recognize many nonprofits, you know, you don't necessarily have huge budgets with which you're operating.
Right.
Every dollar matters. And so, you know, you've got to stay focused on the goal, and you've got to allow for that feedback to happen to really create the right plan. And then as you think about the team that's a part of it, leverage their strengths. That has been something that's been successful for me. You know, I have my own personal strengths, but I've always surrounded myself in a transformation with people who had other strengths, people who could reach people that I couldn't. And that's okay.
Right.
You know, we're one team trying to make it happen. And I think those are a couple additional tips that'll be helpful. But throughout this book, no matter where you are in your transformation journey, I truly believe that you'll find some really practical tips to help you. You know, maybe you're doing well, but let's go from good to great.
Yes.
And hopefully there's some tips in the book that will help you do that as well.
Well, nice shout out to a book that we both like, Jim Collins' Good to Great, and one that you illustrate in your book, which we're absolutely going to lift up in the show notes and encourage our listeners to get this book and learn more. Because if not now, sometime you are going to have to manage change as a nonprofit leader and transformational change. And so you have given them literally a playbook to do that. I'm curious, Adesha, have you been inspired by a book during your professional journey that you might also recommend to our listeners?
Sure. And I know I just talked about strengths. One of my favorite books, as I think about what is the book that I have consistently throughout my 20-year career have come back to, it's actually StrengthFinders 2.0 by
right.
Tom Roth. And really the focus of this book is understanding who you are and what your top five strengths are. And why that's so important, I think, you know, no matter what career choices you make, what role choices you make in life, it's important to understand your values, your purpose, but also your strengths, so that you are always putting yourself in a position and your organization in a position to win. And you surround yourself with people who are strong in other areas as well, because that inspires them to be better. Sometimes we can focus so much on what we're not good at, and I tend to like to focus at what I'm great at. And
yes,
StrengthFinders
yes.
continues to remind me about the things that make me great and where I can contribute most to an organization. So it's a book that I love to leverage. It's a book I love to buy for my team, a new team, right? So that I understand how to orchestrate my team effectively and make sure that each person in my team is successful.
Great recommendation. In addition to wonderful advice throughout our conversation, Daisha, I'm delighted to have you on the podcast. And this episode, I think, is going to give our listeners lots to think about. Where can they go? Where can we put in the show notes for them to find out more about you and the great work you're doing?
Sure. So like all of you, I'm on social media. So you can definitely connect with me on LinkedIn. I would love for you, you know, sometimes people just push connect. I'd love for you to tell me that you're connected from listening to this podcast.
Sure.
So that I understand kind of how we connect and how we meet. You can also follow me on Instagram, and my book also has a website. So that's a place where I'm going to continue to blog and provide additional resources over the long term to really help people who are leading transformations.
That's fantastic. We will happily lift all those options up. And again, Daisha, thank you so much for joining me on the path.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this time. And I wish you all the best as you move forward with your organizations.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Daisha as much as I did and learn many things that can help you on your journey. Certainly change management, if not now, will someday be part of a toolkit that you must manage to lead a nonprofit organization. Don't forget the show notes. They are indeed available on our website, pattonmcdowell.com, where you can find out more about her book, her recommendations, and other episodes like this one that can enhance your professional journey. As always, please share this episode with someone else on the path. If you haven't already, you can subscribe. Again, go to the podcast page at pattonmcdowell.com and you'll see links to all of the primary podcast platforms. And don't miss out on any of our episodes or the bonus ones like this one that come out once a month. Our regular episodes come out every Thursday morning. Thanks for all you're doing in the nonprofit sector, especially right now. And keep up the good work for causes that are most meaningful to you. I'll keep bringing you content that can help you do it even better. Have a great week, and I'll see you next time on The Path.